Hello and welcome to another installment in our 2026 webinar series. Today we are looking at ransomware. Nothing new here, I might hear you say, but this is ransomware 3.0 that we're talking about. Well, why 3.0? We've had lots of .0s in many parts of IT and IT security. But on the ransomware front, if we look at the history, we had 1.0, or just ransomware, as it was called at the time, which really was that evolution. We saw it with WannaCry, with attackers encrypting and extorting organizations to get access to their data and to get their systems back. And when we look at 2.0 as that evolution to go beyond just pure encryption, but also looking at data theft and using it as an additional lever to extort organizations, whether targeting them with with that data, or going straight to either their customers or staff. And then we move on to today and looking at 3.0. And this is really about the latest evolution that has happened or is happening. And really, a lot of that is around AI. So AI is ubiquitous in the world, in our lives. And it's come to malware and ransomware. And this is what my co-host today is going to walk us through. If I just move my slide on there. So I'd like to introduce Chris. Chris, it's a great pleasure to have you on today. Chris is SentinelOne's AI and cloud security evangelist, based in London with a deep passion for all things cloud security. He regularly speaks on the evolving nature of AI-powered attacks, the security challenges facing teams building with AI, and the realities of cloud and container breaches. And all this is alongside a very candid view on why today's cloud security tooling, while more powerful than ever, still falls short. With over a decade of experience in cybersecurity, Chris has helped organizations of all sizes adopt, scale, and secure cloud technologies with confidence. Before joining SentinelOne, he's built a career in Australia, holding roles at CrowdStrike, Trend Micro, and Progress Software. Having worked across diverse regions and cultures, Chris brings a global perspective to cybersecurity, focused on keeping AI-driven and cloud-native environments resilient in the face of modern threats. So, definitely the man for the job today, Chris. Welcome to the webinar.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm excited for this one.
Excellent. So just before we kick off and before I hand over to Chris, just a tiny bit of housekeeping around the webinar. So firstly, we have, and you should have at the bottom of your Zoom bar there, a QA function as part of this webinar. So please pop any questions in there. Put myself and Chris to the test, or mostly Chris. I'll probably palm those off to you on anything that that you'd like to know around ransomware and any parts that we've discussed during today's webinar. We're also recording this session. A link will be provided by the lovely Rebecca, who's running things in the background here for us. So please feel free to share with colleagues or watch back in the future. And lastly, we also have translated captions available for you to use. And again, that should be at the bottom of your webinar bar. So, Chris, that is probably my intro done. What I'm going to do is I'm going to stop sharing and I will hand control over to yourself to kick things off.
All right. Thank you, sir. Let's get going. There's a lot that we want to cover today, so I'm just going to dive right in, if that's all right with the audience and all right with you, Rich.
Yeah, let's go.
Specifically, I wanted to cover the evolving ecosystem that sits around ransomware and ransomware as a service operators, and then pivot to how that's changing now and where I think the changes are going to keep going. When we talk about ransomware 3.0, it's worth noting that we're like not day one, but we're at like day maybe 100 or 180, or we're early on in the cycle here. And so a lot of what I'm going to present today are some of the changes that we're seeing in motion and forecasting where they think they're going to lead us to. But anyway, inflection point, e-crime meets AI crime, how threat actors are even abusing AI. And then what's needed for thorough protection against ransomware, which is defending primary vectors. So let's talk about the ecosystem first, as it's important to understand where ransomware sits. the cybercrime ecosystem has different levels of who makes what money, but there's different operations. It's quite a complex architecture. There are those that specialize in achieving access, those that specialize in finding 0 days, and then you have ransomware as a service operators who are professionals at understanding exfil data, crafting ransom notes, negotiation. And so often you'll see a threat actor that maybe is incredible at finding exposed credentials. They get into an organization and then they'll bring in a ransomware as a service operator to expand that breach and to deploy the ransomware. Sometimes they'll get access to the ransomware as malware. Sometimes they'll just hand the reins over to that operator. And then there's a profit split. There's then separate people again who are then going to launder the money out. But it's a robust ecosystem. We used to have really well-known operators that sat at the top, that and the headlines would reflect sort of their primacy. I'm talking about groups like Lockbit or R-Evil or Black Cat. These groups have had tremendous legal pressures. There's been a lot of disruption of those organizations, and that's splintered the ecosystem somewhat. We're now seeing a sort of a decline of the large operators and more opportunistic operators that are springing up and down. Often these are the exact same players. They're rebranding, they're giving themselves a new name, they've got a shiny new website that talks about the data that they've stolen, but they're rebranding to avoid prosecution. Alongside this sort of splintering of large families of ransomware into smaller groups, we're seeing ransomware operators now, rather than waiting for any person with an access into an organization to approach them to say, hey, we want to work with trusted initial access brokers. We want to work with people that we know are, I don't want to say good corporate citizens because it's bad e-crime citizens, but those that they know that aren't going to bring any heat on them from a law enforcement perspective and that have verified access. And so that's the first sort of pivot that we're currently seeing and that I expect to see more of. Ransomware 3.0 prediction is that this era of mega brands is going to continue to fracture. Already in 2026, we're seeing the rise of groups like The Gentlemen, Obscura, that appeared late 25 or early 2026 and are already having quite an impact on the ransomware scene. What we do expect is to see continued investment in obfuscation, in defense evasion, and the reuse of tools. I'll go out on a limb here and say that I don't believe that we're going to see any net new ransomware malware that is inherently different than those that we've seen in the past. Malware's malware, right? At the end of the day, it's just instructions packaged differently. I expect we'll see, because that Lockbit, you even had like within them, they had 1.0, 2.0, 3.0 as they move between mega milestones of tooling. We're just going to see a lot more chop and churn. Info stealers from here, malware from here. And then what's going to be newer is how AI is going to chain things together, but a lot of reuse. Some things that we're already seeing as a result of these smaller operators, as a result of increased legal pressure, is a tendency away from artifacts and IOCs for smaller operators. So, for example, not dropping a ransom note and having a direct follow-up of that's and that's emails or that's a phone call. Penguin Cartel, for example, is already operating like this, where it's changing your first notification to not be a clue for law enforcement later on.
Sorry, Chris, just to jump in there, just to,
Oh, please, Rich.
and I suppose do you think that that is going to change? You talked about the I mean, sorry, in general, I have an issue with attribution, so how accurate it can be, and the answer sometimes is actually you don't need to do some heavy analysis investigation to attribute it, because they're putting it on their breach site and proudly waving the flag to say, we've breached you, we have your data, here's the evidence. Is that something that you see very much changing in terms of moving away from those breach sites to become much more covert in that publishing and advertising to avoid that the pressure from law enforcement?
Well, it's interesting. We've already seen this move from double extortion to triple extortion, where one is, hey, we've stolen your data, we're going to leak it, and we've encrypted it. So if you need it back, and that's the double method. The triple method is often bringing in law enforcement. Interestingly, last year, the average dwell time of threat actors was 12 days. It was only 12 days because 35% of the incidents, the attacker told them 5 days in, hey, we're in your system, or they began the ransomware attack, right? I don't think we're going to see the disappearance of those sites. However, I think we're going to see some ransomware actors operate without them if they're going to be directly communicating with their victims. And I think that's going to be the difference between something like ransomware focusing on SMB versus that corporate big game hunting. We may not hear about the big game breach. They'll certainly hear about it. The regulators will, but they might hold back on public displays of those breaches to try and ward off law enforcement eyes. And I've actually got an interesting example of another trend I think is hitting attribution a little bit later on in the present. But to continue on attribution, something that I think it's also worthwhile noting is that nation state threat actors, often we see some of them moonlight for profit. You know, if they've got some spare hours, why not run an extortion scheme? But also we're observing it used as operational cover so that you can say, oh, there's been a ransomware attack. It's some unknown criminal. And that shields that from potentially, no, this is a military intelligence GRU specific attack from Russia. So there's operational cover by trying to make attribution messiness by being destructive by leveraging ransomware. So let's talk about the AI inflection point, because this is what's driving ransomware 3.0 alongside that legal pressure. I think we're all aware that AI is changing the threat landscape and that it represents an opportunity not just for attackers, for defenders. What does that inflection point look like? And before I start, there's a few things that I'm going to cover today that are on their face, the nature of it, scary. Please know that I'm not presenting anything in this deck for fear, uncertainty, doubt reasons. More, we need to understand the challenge in order to overcome it. And something I will say is that our defenders community is always much more collaborative than the attacker community is. The fact that we can share threat intelligence, that we have bodies that are both professional and government-led that are focused on bringing us all together to defeat this challenge, I think that speaks volumes of our intentions and the right direction we're heading in. But we also need clarity. And so, for example, we need to move away from just the headlines. August late last year, for example, there were splashy headlines about the first ever AI-powered ransomware, only for that to be published later on and much less discussed that that was in fact not seen in the wild, but was a not an experiment's not the right word, but you guys get what I mean. It was an academic project and a proof of concept run out of a team from NYU. So, to talk about how AI is impacting ransomware, I think it's worthwhile me pointing out right off the top the classic outcomes of profit, disruption, influence, and access. All of these are now achieved with AI. Specifically, it's lowering the entry barrier, it's accelerating operations, and it's enabling sophistication for low and mid-tier operatives. So let's talk about what's changing. And this is kind of the evolution of e-crime into AI crime. Well, we already have an example of a UK-based threat actor generating net new ransomware variants and building out a ransomware as a service model by leveraging Claude Code. And very interestingly, the Anthropic, the makers of Claude, were quick to point out that this particular operator didn't actually seem particularly technically competent, and then he very heavily leveraged what Claude was able to do. But we've already sort of got an example of people that are building out malware with AI. But again, as I mentioned at the start, malware is just malware. There's more interesting use cases of AI by the ransomware community in reconnaissance, content support, and threat operations. To give a really quick example, I'm not actually going to talk about ransomware, I'm going to talk about an extortion effort, but on the face of them, they're quite similar. This one's now interaction in Russian language and the TTPs match historic Russian e-crime. That's not official attribution, but a guess of where this might be. This impacted more than 17 organizations across Europe and the UK, but they automated VPN endpoint reconnaissance and understood, hey, their victims, what regulations do they sit within? What kind of companies are they? They built net new API-driven scanning frameworks. Interestingly, there was sort of better and better defense evasion capabilities as they iterated. They were using Chisel libraries, for example, at the start. Then they replaced all that functionality, but still without any of the libraries. But what I wanted to focus on is the operations side. They leveraged an LLM to organize and understand stolen data and craft ransom notes in response to that data. If I'm thinking about something like Clop, who is a big ransomware as a service operator house, who were behind the MOVEit breach, which actually comes from a previous organization, not while I was there, but that's that MOVEit's a progress technology. That attack was automated. It happened over a weekend, a holiday weekend, 3 days. It took months for that campaign to run its course because Clop themselves were slowing themselves down so they could negotiate with every victim and understand the data that they had stolen. Well, in this case study, we've got this threat actor that's feeding in exfiltrated data to an LLM to say, what's sensitive here? What can I use? And with your understanding of the regulation and the country and the field that they sit in, how should I build a ransom note? And this will make sense. If we're stealing data from a, let's say, hospital, why don't we scan for, do any of the patient records match local politicians? That might be something more juicier to work with that you can threaten someone with, especially if it's connected to maybe they have someone on the board that comes from that same political party. But this kind of LLM amplified understanding of data is even more promising when you have this roll out across multiple languages. Threat actors may be proficient in English, they may not know what the Indonesian word for one of the many Indonesian languages words is for invoice, or the German word for sensitive. And so this ability to search for what you're looking for across languages, it's a clear amplification of skills. And then to Rich, to your point earlier about how we will people get louder or will they get quieter about the breaches that they've conducted, we're also seeing LLMs assist the mimicry of breaches. So back in 2021, a threat actor called Babok hit up the Washington DC's police force, and here's their response. A few months later, they got a lot of heat from this, legal heat obviously, and so they actually shut down their operations. Well, last year, a threat actor claimed to be Babok and then republished some of these breaches as if they were net new. And you can even see the mistake they made when they first uploaded it, of calling it the 21 breach and then renaming it as the 25 breach. We expect to see LLMs generate sort of plausible sounding narratives on existing data that's out there to promote breaches that don't exist. And this is sort of par for the course. This is a landscape that exaggerates for effect. I know of one very high-profile technology company that had a breach where the threat actor said, hey, I'm in I'm in Asana, I'm in GitHub, I can see your source code. Turns out what they'd been able to access through a third-party IT worker was Slack, and Slack had screenshots of Asana, of some projects that people were working on. Had nowhere near the access that this person claimed to have. But if you're bombastic, you might get paid quicker, you might get paid more.
And to chime in there, our incident
Of course.
response team have seen exactly that with threat actors claiming to have control of OT environments, threatening a big impact, but actually what they've done is they've compromised one of the systems team's machines, and which had screenshots on it. So the screenshots they were showing, although real, were not down to their access. And just ask a quick question there, Chris. So, obviously this repurposing and mimicking of attacks. Do you think that's, on the one hand, to try and be able to fake an attack and try and extort, or is it to keep law enforcement busy and not looking at the actual problem, or being used as, a bit of a smokescreen for other attacks?
So I certainly agree that in most cases, it's the first. It's an attempt for profit as fast as possible. And then the second half of it, I don't believe it's a smokescreen so much as I've seen some new threat actors leverage this as a way of padding their resume ahead of a breach. They can say, here's the list of who we've hit. And people are like, oh, I remember the name of that breach, or I know that organization. That's a big organization. And it looks plausible. They can go, oh, wow, maybe they did breach retailer A that's incredibly large. I'm retailer B, I'm gonna be scared. It's so not so much of a smokescreen as a potential steroid use there to try and bump up their claims.
Yeah, I think that's interesting.
Of course, a lot of what I've sort of covered so far has been operating alongside LLMs, generative AI. The ongoing AI crime evolution is going to continue into agentic AI. I think we're all seeing what's possible, and my background's actually a reference to OpenClaw. SentinelOne just published an open source security tool for OpenClaw called ClawSec. I'll stop talking about my company, but I think we're all aware that AI is now performing actions, right? Something that we assume and we're already seeing the attempt at this is agent specific for negotiation, because then negotiation can be multilingual, it can be tone controlled. Previously, in that 2.0 era of ransomware, they would actually have dedicated HR functions, dedicated support functions with multi-language support so that they could communicate and arrive at profit as quick as possible. They were even offering things like discounts if you paid on time and promises to not attack you again. Or they'd say like, hey, we'll give you 12 months. That's quite human intensive. Let's shift that operation to an agent. This again is going to help smaller teams operate quicker and not need so much infrastructure, which obviously brings a lot of legal heat.
I think that's when us defenders and organizations can use AI jailbreaking to our benefit. Similar to that example, there was a researcher that tricked Chevrolet's online agent to sell him a car for $1, and state that it's entirely legal and binding. So there you go. Maybe that'll be the next form of negotiation, is jailbreaking the AI to get off very lightly.
And on that jailbreaking, I'd be keen to chat about jailbreaking briefly, because a question I ask often is, how are these threat actors abusing AI to become AI enabled? Quite a lot of threat actors have been creating, those that have been creating malware via AI do so in a modular fashion. Nobody's saying, hey, please write me ransomware. It's always bit by bit by bit by bit. And so here's a case study from late last year. This is an info stealer, not a ransomware, but they were able to change existing compiled exes into shellcode, in-memory loaders, passing and scraping for browser credentials, obfuscate their activities, crypt up what they found, archive and ship, out through Telegram. None of this in itself is dangerous. You put it all together, you stitch it together offline, you've got info stealer malware. We're already seeing threat actors adopt a multimodal, multi-model approach to this modular creation, where they give the same task to, let's say, five different LLMs. Maybe three of them say no, two of them will say yes. And so a prediction for ransomware ahead is that, well, I believe we're going to see this become commoditized as well, as better training comes out on how to build out a multimodal system. And I believe we're going to see a prompt smuggling as a service business, where you can start to build out more complex chains of architecture and operations specifically by having one query that goes out and having a system that plugs it together for you. But that being offered as a discrete sort of e-crime system platform. In terms of jailbreaking, historically we've seen these sort of so-called dark LLMs. These haven't been specifically trained LLMs in the dark arts. This is just popular third-party models like Mixtral, like Claude, like ChatGPT, like Gemini that have been jailbroken. And on the screen, actually, I have the message that was leveraged against Mixtral to ensure that it would answer any specific question. There's no code in a jailbreak. It's just simple. It's trying to reroute how it approaches questions to bypass those security guardrails. But I should note that we're now essentially moving away from those dark LLMs, and instead, threat actors are looking at open source models or open weight models, where you can more easily bypass security models by running those on premise or privately, because then you can bypass a lot of the cloud filters and a lot of the cloud analysis on the kind of prompts that you're using. Specifically, OLLaMA, which you can use to run whatever model you want. We've got some phenomenal research on OLLaMA, by the way, and here's an example of those that are the nations where it's being widely leveraged. We think OLLaMA itself will be more and more targeted so that threat actors will be able to hijack compute and leverage someone else's environment to run attacks out of. But we also believe that OLLaMA presents an opportunity for threat actors to leverage open source models and build out these AI-enabled operations while bypassing security guardrails and running that all locally, which further makes identifying them and detecting that activity to be quite difficult. And finally, I want to talk about the trend of AI-enabled malware, which is an immature field but rapidly evolving and due to impact the ransomware world shortly. SentinelOne has published some phenomenal research here. We actually found what we think is the earliest example of LLM-enabled malware, which is malware that calls an LLM in real time, so it interacts in real time, called Malterminal. We know that's from 23 because you can tell how old the API keys are because those changed. But as a few examples of what other malware is doing, Lamehug is in real time querying an LLM and getting it to generate Go commands, which means that there's no sort of hash or signature here. It's always going to be slightly different to the execution of these reconnaissance and data exfil commands. Fruit Shell, interestingly, has hard-coded defense evasion prompts. So if you're looking for it with an LLM, it goes, "Hey, I'm not malware. Don't say I'm malware." And Quiet Vault looks for localized AI CLI tooling like Claude Code, and then has that run commands for it to perform credential theft. So this is all sort of AI cognizant malware. We expect to see that hit the ransomware market shortly, which is going to further complicate detection and attribution. But just that ability to, in real time, query an LLM as part of the operation. And I think the rise of agents is going to further compound that issue of feedback through a threat operation. Hey, we've stolen this data. Where should we head to next? We have this access to this, let's say, cloud environment. Where should we pivot to next? Any questions before I go on?
Not for all, but we'll save the questions. I can see some going into the Q&A, and we'll save those to the very end.
Okay, so I've covered quite a bit quite quickly about some of the developments that we're seeing with ransomware. What hasn't really changed is the defense against ransomware. I feel like the stakes have changed. The inherent defense protocols haven't. We need to harden and educate. Despite coming from a security vendor, I genuinely believe one of the most important security assets any organization can have is its human firewall. If we're able to educate our workforce to try and even on things like how they rotate their passwords, how they go about building those passwords, reusing them across other environments which might be more easily breached, that's going to have such a net impact on our security posture. Enforcing MFA, this has got to be lowest stakes. As I mentioned at the very top of this presentation, ransomware isn't something that hits you, it's something that is deployed. Within your environment, you first need access, and that access is always stolen credentials or exposed credentials, stolen identities. Patching expeditiously, the speed at which new vulnerabilities can be invoked has really decreased. I come from a cloud background. There's been a campaign January and February this year, leveraging that React 2 shell vulnerability from December last year, that's impacted thousands of organizations. If something is exploitable and if it is reachable, I don't feel particularly new and innovative saying this, but patching is necessary,
And just
which I suppose you then need prioritizing of what should be worked out first.
there is, and I think just that speed is probably one of those things that we'll see more and more of, is the ability to create malware, to exploit them, getting a lot, getting a hell of a lot faster. We've seen examples where threat actors are just pointing an LLM at a security researcher's exploit that they've, or the vulnerability they've found, just then create the code. Now, not brilliantly, but it's there, and I'm sure it will improve over time.
Absolutely. Finally, lockdown remote access. Obviously, remote access tooling is thing number one to be on the look for. Like, yes, some of that is going to be used by your IT admin team. We should understand what exactly, like, let's understand what tools are in use, what isn't in use, how are VPNs able to access our environment, what's possible in terms of accessing what environments. And obviously, that's often best achieved through segmentation and control. The best way to limit an attack is to ensure that whatever environment they're in, they're unable to bump up their privileges within that environment. They're unable to traverse outside of that environment. This is going to limit any sort of impact. There's a good word that I usually use here that I've absolutely forgotten. Not the scale of an impact, but the shockwaves of an impact. That's going to come to me in 10 minutes' time after we're done talking here, I know. Anyway, harden, educate, MFA, patch, lockdown, remote access, segmentation, and control. And then there's some further sort of tech recommendations. Of course, Chris here comes from a cyber vendor, but modern EDR is critical for a few reasons. One, understanding the behavior of a threat as it unfolds is now more critical than ever. If an LLM is being used to dynamically generate new commands in real time, we're not going to be able to have any example to look back on of, oh, this is similar to that, beyond behavior. What is it trying to achieve? And most modern EDRs are built, have some understanding of that concept of what's known. And also, what does behavior look like? Central to modern detection and response is also the protection and monitoring of identity. Has your identity been involved in a breach elsewhere without your organization? Are you using the same password as you did on your Gmail, on your Netflix, or wherever. How quickly can we understand changes in MFA activity? How quickly can we understand if an identity has been compromised and if a compromised identity is in use? Application access and device control continues to be an old lesson that yields new results and increased postures. If we're able to lock things down, similar to that segmentation that we see on the network side, we're going to have a good time. Data backup and encryption, not always possible. I appreciate this. You can't just have a second version of your entire company waiting for you to switch over to in case your environment gets hit by ransomware. There's also the challenge of not knowing at what point you've been breached. If there is a longer dwell time, you might have a backup that includes persistence for attackers. That said, this is still the best way to ensure resilience from an attack is business continuity services and backup. And then finally, IR readiness. You're only as good as you are on the day that you need to perform. If you don't practice, if you don't rehearse, you're due for a shock. And that goes from the practitioner level up to the C-suite. You don't want your C-suite being caught unawares of how to manage press at a time of a large outage. That's something that they need to be trained on, as well as your SOC level one analyst needs to be trained on. We've got weird things coming up with an MFA. What do I need to investigate next? How quickly should I revoke that session? We should have equal practicing and rehearsals on in both of those examples. To finish up here, I'll just mention that, of course, SentinelOne is a security company, and this is the kind of things that we help people with. I'm not going to talk at all about what it is we do beyond just mentioning that our focus is on how can we improve an analyst's experience and how can we drastically update that. If it's people, process, technology, it's technology to improve processes to help people's lives. We're big on autonomous security, human amplification, intuitive by design, which leads to values like ensuring protection, ensuring an effective security operation team, and enabling growth and enabling the adoption of AI. But that's well and truly enough company slides from me. If you want to find out more about us, you know where to find us. It's the company and add a .com on the end. But that's the material that I wanted to cover today. Ransomware 3.0, how AI is changing it, enabling it, and what are some trends that I think are coming up next? And then how do we protect against it? Close the front door in the first instance. Always the best advice.
Brilliant, Chris. That was absolutely excellent. I'm just going to steal the share from you very quickly
Please.
as we get into the Q&A. But just before we get into the Q&A, yeah, I'm also going to do a shameless plug. We've got some upcoming webinars for everybody. So please use the QR code and join. So the next one coming up is Taming the SaaS Sprawl. And obviously, we have our Security First conferences that we're running around EMEA and, potentially soon to come, even further afield. So again, all of that's accessible via the QR code. So let's get into the Q&A. And just before I start that, Chris, we've got three guesses in for what that word is that you couldn't quite reach.
I think Johnny
So,
O'Rourke takes the crown
okay, so
here.
John O'Rourke went for blast radius, which is going to be my guess as well. But we also had Lucy Jennings with repercussions and Christian with magnitude. Which I think all of them could potentially apply there. But the gold star goes to Johnny. So let's get into the questions. Actually, we'll start with Johnny's question. He has asked, how do you check that for how do you check that at the network layer? So AI-enabled malware, presumably the malware is hitting a private LLM on some custom port and unlikely to be plain text. So how do you identify that?
I'm not sure I would go looking for that at the network layer. I'd be trying to look in terms of like examining that at the perimeter or at the switch. I would look for network interactions, but I would try and look for that with endpoint telemetry to see what behavior is happening in real time. Are tools being invoked? How are processes being spawned, essentially? You can start to see some clues. But it's also worthwhile noting that, and there's some phenomenal research that some of my colleagues have done, is we can actually move from hunting IOCs and hashes to hunting things like API keys for LLMs. All of the major LLMs can share what the base 64 encoding of their API key is. So you can actually right now go into your environment. And so, sorry that I don't have it on the screen, but I can send to Rich and he can forward it on. But you can go in and hunt for, has the ChatGPT API key been seen across any interactions? And obviously, you hopefully know how ChatGPT is being used within your own organization, but it might help you find clues of, hey, there's been this API interaction that is outside of perhaps any approved usages of ChatGPT.
Yeah, and I think that is going to, as you say, particularly if you're looking at the network layer, I think that is going to be one of the challenges. Yes, if it's going off to, potentially to a custom LLM, but again, how are you going to look at that, even if it's encrypted? Not many people these days are doing full decryption of every single packet leaving their organization. But some of those examples you gave, Chris, were utilizing off the shelf LLMs. So, unless you're blocking access to all of those except the organization approved LLM, which is potentially restrictive, I think it's going to be very difficult, and it has to be looking at what the behavior and activity is beyond just looking at calls out to LLMs. So thank you for that question, Johnny. And we've got quite a few questions, but we have got some time, so hopefully we'll get through all of them. One question is there a new or unbeatable ransomware around the corner that we should know about?
Yeah, I don't believe so. I believe there's absolutely new iterations and new operators that will have their time in the sun, but I don't think there's anything particularly different about one ransomware strain versus another ransomware strain. I will say that threat actors are doing what they can to understand how they can get over defenses, something that we see within that cybercrime ecosystem that I talked about is also people faking organizations to buy security technology to then deploy that and see if they can beat it within their own environment. So I think there's splashy ransomware ahead, but not necessarily anything inherently net new in terms of functionality. I think the way in which encryption happens, for example, remote encryption, the different styles of encryption, I think we're not going to see new stuff there.
I think we've taken it probably as I say they have taken it probably as far as they can go from that perspective. As you say, it's just a but probably more targeted, the ability to move faster, which it just means that we need to sort of it'll keep us on our toes at the very least. So just probably on that vein, actually, there's a question is, what's one thing that you would recommend doing right now to protect against ransomware? I think you probably might have already covered those, but is there anything extra, or actually, out of those things you covered, what's number one?
I'm going to give a bad answer. The number one would be two things, which is for me, it's ensuring that whatever endpoint protection you have is capable of understanding behavior in real time. So we're not just looking for malware and blocking it, but looking at behavior and have specific mitigation capabilities. This isn't only SentinelOne. A lot of us do this, but a lot of us have different ways in which we're able to revert a compromised environment back into a healthy state. That's critical. And then the second part, which is still my one po most important thing, is identity security. If we've got no understanding of where MFA is within our organization, changes in logins, understanding non-human identities as well as machine identities as well as human identities, knowing if employees have been part of breaches elsewhere, that's so critical because that's the open door that's going to allow a ransomware attack to happen.
Very good. So we've got another question in here to say, we have different AI-enabled solutions on the market. Actually, that's security solutions. What are the main points or features that distinguish, SentinelOne from others? This is your opportunity, Chris, for, what's your USP?
Oh, I wouldn't necessarily want to go on and make this a laundry list of distinguishing features. I think for me, a lot what's often more different than features is approach to inherently what problem different security providers trying to solve. And where SentinelOne has always had its most extreme focus is on that two flip coins of how can we build security to be as autonomous as possible. We believe in autonomous security intelligence, which is not to say buy some technology and you don't have to have a SOC anymore, but how can we help people on a journey to essentially coping with the machine speed of threats with machine scale defense? And then that second half is a focus on improving analysts' lives and analyst workflow. The way in which we often build our features are around making something drastically quicker, making something much more intuitive, providing things out of the box. Easy examples would be, LLM summarization of attacks, of activity that's been taken. Just how can we improve SOC lives, essentially? Apologies that that wasn't a very thorough answer, but that's it
No,
on the
that'll
tin, essentially.
do. Yeah. My new favorite attendee, which is Johnny's, actually challenging that response. So this is what I like to see. And talking about, well, actually, we talked about the potential for trying to identify potential malware, AI-enabled malware use that's using off-the-shelf frontier LLMs. But I guess the question is, and the view is actually that, is that unlikely due to the guardrails that are in place?
So I'll dive in and say the use of ChatGPT, Gemini, Claude in AI-enabled malware has been a presence because we've often seen threat operators leverage the tools that they know. That's already now in the past. In fact, we've got some phenomenal research about our researchers hunting for API keys, those base 64 keys, and there's phenomenal models from exactly the public providers that you would expect. Part of why I did want to mention the pivot to OLAMA is because we're going to see more open weight, open source models, and not necessarily those that are immediately recognizable and known. There's certainly a massive adoption of models out of China where the approach to open source is slightly different. Models like Qwen, we're already seeing that leveraged quite heavily by the threat community. We also expect that base 64 encoded strings of being able to hunt for API keys. We think that threat actors are going to obfuscate that shortly as well. So yes, Johnny, you're absolutely right that spawning it is going to be increasingly complicated. That complexity is already in motion, happening even more so. I think at the end of the day, it's almost kind of not going to matter if the malware is AI enabled or not, so much as can you understand what it's trying to do, where it originated from, and do you have the capabilities to respond to it? Like whether or not it's malware that has pre-compiled bashes to do info stealing, or whether it's generating net new info stealing commands in real time, the core requirement for security is understand it, stop it, find out how it was able to happen. For example, that React 2 shell vulnerability that's proving to be quite deadly for a lot of cloud and container environments.
And AI is inherent weakness is the fact that it's processing natural language that can be interpreted in multiple ways. So those guardrails, that jailbreaking is always going to be an issue. Now, obviously, the guardrails will get better and better. But even Anthropic, at the end of last year, announced that they'd seen, I think it might have been the start of this year, but had observed a Chinese threat actor using clawed as part of an attack. Now that wasn't as didn't go into as much depth as the headlines kind of grab, but that example that you gave, Chris, of the Russian threat actor, as you say, it wasn't entirely a malware-based one, but more info stealer to extort, and obviously extortion's part of that. Yes, if you're asking, a direct ask, create me some malware. But if you're piecing those together, and actually, when we see that when when a method of jailbreaking is identified, unless it's being advertised, it's very hard to suddenly go, actually, we need to fix that. It's we see it with security researchers, and in fact, actually, I saw a presentation by a security researcher where he was doing a live demo, and actually, he'd published the jailbreaking exploit on his website only the day previous, and but it had been fixed by then because obviously they're trawling that, and he's a well-known person. So if they're keeping it to themselves, then the ability to jailbreak is actually there. But as you say, we might not see, potentially see less and less of that, and more open source and harder to identify.
If I'm able to build an Llama network with seven different models that's running that are separate from cloud monitoring because they're now running within my environment, I can just spam those and see what works and then kind of bit by bit make my way there. As always, a little bit of complexity makes things a lot easier sometimes.
So, last question here that we have is, are we going to see a change in the nature of ransomware following the NIS2 implementation for mandatory notifications to the NCSC in Ireland? And if that's true, is that connected to the wiper attack, and that attackers change their vector so that destruction can persist?
Just to call out, I thank you for this question, Ilias. I didn't mention wipers within the presentation. I really should have. More and more, we're seeing wipers become a part of ransomware attacks as well to showcase destructive capability along as part of that tripling extortion method. The NIS2 notification mandate is a sword that cuts both ways. I generally and genuinely believe that NIS2, the Cyber Resilience Bill here, DORA over in Europe, and the EU AI Act, that's all a rising tide that will keep all boats, lifting higher. We need this kind of regulation because it helps unlock budget for us to have these projects to increase our security posture. They're generally good things for us to follow. At the same time, it can be incredibly difficult to understand what the scope is of a breach within the timelines that they have. It's like one day notification, then 1 month a full report. When we have threat actors that have limited access, but they've then found screenshots and they're trying to say that they have more access than they in fact have, we don't want to notify all of our customer base too soon and have our collective audience of users and security users desensitized to constant breaches left, right, and center. That's not going to help them stay vigilant with new passwords everywhere or however they want to stay vigilant. I think NIS2 has been built to have additional flexibility. I don't see the mandatory notification window changing. But certainly, we've already seen threat actors weaponize regulation against their victims, notifying them and crunching their deadlines.
Yeah, perfect. Okay, we are just approaching the hour, and we try and keep these well within that. I'm going to say thank you very much, Chris. I think this has been a brilliant webinar. Excellent co-host, and great some great subjects there, and great interaction and answers. I'm going to thank everybody for joining, and obviously thanks Rebecca on our marketing team for making sure that we're able to run this webinar. So thank you very much to everybody, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you all.